For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. So we are pretty much at the climax of the book of Revelation. I entitled this section, The Old Order Has Passed Away. We'll see that this is really the moment of transition, not only in the book of Revelation, but in human history, where God finally establishes his kingdom that he's been talking about throughout the Bible. Let's begin and pick up where we left off last time in chapter 20, verse 7. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand on the seashore. So last time we were together in Revelation, you can recall that we talked about this 1,000-year reign of Christ that he establishes on earth. And during this period, Satan is bound so that he's no longer able to deceive the nations. And that during this time period, under Christ's reign, there is relative peace, safety, and unity. But at the end of this 1,000-year period, apparently Satan is released one more time, and he's able to deceive the nations yet one more time, and he gathers all the nations from the four corners of the earth to prepare for battle. I think this is interesting because one of the things that really is a question, a burning question, comes up in the book of Revelation is, why does Jesus need this temporary reign on earth, this 1,000-year reign, before he finally establishes the new heavens and new earth? This actually might be an explanation for that. That even though people are under Christ's rule, even though there is safety and peace, and you know, that people are enjoying this in an unprecedented way, that at the end, God is able to show once again that the human race, every chance it gets, will rebel against God. That the problem is not our environment, it's not our upbringing, it's not any of those factors, but instead, it's the fact that the human heart is corrupt and is susceptible to the seduction of Satan. Incidentally, I think this is an interesting point as well to consider that, you know, when we talk about the problem of evil, a lot of times when we consider it on a philosophical level, we only talk about it from the standpoint of free choice, that human beings are ultimately responsible for the evil in the world, that it wasn't God who created it. But I think any answer to the problem of evil that excludes Satan really is incomplete. Because we see here that under Jesus' reign, the human race is relatively unified and that there is peace. But the moment that Satan is released from this bondage, he's able to gather all of the people of the earth in rebellion against God for one final battle. We're told that where they mention Gog and Magog again. We talked about this in the final battle, Armageddon. But apparently, Gog and Magog in this context refers to not just kings from the north who are, you know, related to the Caspian and Black Sea historically, but instead this represents the nations that are in open defiance against God. While they marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves, an unmistakable reference to Jerusalem. And so apparently all the armies of the earth come together and march onto God's city, probably the capital where he and his followers are reigning on earth. But we're told that there's no battle. At that moment when they arrive, fire came down from heaven and devoured them. God finally has stomped out this rebellion. And at this point, I think that there's enough evidence to suggest that God has gone to the greatest extent possible to make sure that human beings had evidence that he is good. He died on the cross. He reigned for 1,000 years on earth with peace and safety. and unity. And even that at the end of all that, the human race continues to rebel against God. And so finally, he stomps out this rebellion. We're told in verse 10, and the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And so Satan, the actor who brought about the first accusation against God's character, that God is not loving, that he claims to be this benevolent God who wants to give good things to his children, but the fact is he's actually a tyrant. And God, obviously, if he decided at that moment when Satan launched this accusation and rebelled against him, decided to stomp that out, he may have destroyed Satan, but there is that lingering accusation as to whether or not God's character was good. And so God knew that he had to go to great lengths to prove his goodness. And so now that he's demonstrated his goodness, he throws the evil one into the lake of burning fire, as we're told, where he'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. We're told in Matthew 25, verse 41 by Jesus, that Jesus says that in the end, he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed in the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels." Apparently, the lake of fire or hell is actually reserved for Satan and his angelic beings who have fallen away from God, but that human beings, casualties in this war, who've decided that they're going to listen to Satan and his lies, have to follow his final destiny as well. Verse 11, "Then I saw a great white throne, and on him who was seated on it." So John sees this incredible white throne descending in heaven, from heaven. You know, the picture of white, or the color white in Revelation, represents God's graciousness, his glory, and his righteousness. And so this is clearly a reference to God himself coming to judge the nations. We're told that earth and the sky fled from his presence and there was no place for them. In this kind of metaphorical language, John sees the earth and heaven flee from the presence of God because of his magnificence. "And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and the books were open. Another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books." So there are two kinds of books that are mentioned here. The first is the books, plural. And John identifies these books as the books that record the works of those who are dead and who, based on what's written in these books, are judged by. You know, this is going to be an intense scene. I'm not sure if it's literally going to be books, but I think John's trying to depict what he's seeing here. You know, it's like a huge stack of books containing your life's works, you know, gets rolled out in the end. And, you know, for some of us, it's going to be a bigger pile than others. I'm sure that if God rolled out my book of works, you know, they'd have to probably load up a semi with it and, you know, pull it all out, depicting every period of my life. You know, some of you are going to look at that book up at the top and be like, "Oh man, that was freshman year of high school. That was such a weird time for me." "Oh, look at that book right there. That's the goth period. I was doing real weird things during that time." You know? And you're going to be able to see different stages. "Oh, there was that emo period where I used people and then cried about it listening to Bright Eyes." And so we're told that based on the things that are recorded in the books, different stages of our lives, that God is going to bring about justice for the things that we've done wrong. And one of the things that's interesting is that there's no mention here of, you know, sort of a balance of works between good works and bad works. And I think a lot of times today there's this popular notion that, you know, if you want to get into heaven, it's really about making sure that there's a balance. You know, if you do some bad things, you got to make sure that you're doing some good works or good things to try to, you know, make sure to even that out. There's no mention of that here. There's really only two types of books. There are the books, plural, which contain our works, which we'll be judged by. And then there's another book, which is the book of life, which gives us admittance into heaven. And the Bible says that the only way that we can actually have our names written in the book of life is by coming into a personal relationship with Jesus. It's not about doing good things. It's not about trying to avoid bad things, because God himself is morally perfect. And so for us to suggest that we can waltz into God's presence and show him our good works is an affront to his character. Because anything that we bring before him is going to be tainted because we're morally imperfect. And we're told in verse 13, the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in it. And each person was judged according to what he had done. And so we're told that the sea gave up the dead, that death and Hades gave up the dead. A lot of times people think that Hades is referring to hell, but actually this is talking about an intermediate state where people who have died apart from Christ are awaiting the final judgment. And we're told that Hades gave up the dead. This suggests that people in this final time are resurrected for the final judgment. One of the things that's interesting is that when you look at this, there seems to be no mention of believers. In fact, we're told in chapter 20, verse 6, blessed and holy are those who have taken part in the first resurrection. The second death will have no power over them. And so apparently all who have died that believe in all generations are reigning with Christ and won't actually have to face this judgment here. We're told in verse 14, then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. The second death is referring to not physical death, which is the first death, but the second death, which is eternal spiritual death. You know, the biblical idea of death is separation. And so we talk about the first death or physical death. We're separated from our physical bodies. Our soul is separated from that. In the second death, it's a spiritual death. And so we are eternally separated from God. And we're told that those who experience the second death are put into or thrown into the lake of fire. Now, this term, lake of fire, is synonymous with other types of judgment language in the New and Old Testament. For example, the lake of fire is synonymous with everlasting destruction that's talked about in 2 Thessalonians 1:9 and Gehenna in Matthew 10, verse 28. You know, Gehenna described a valley outside of the city gates of Jerusalem called the Valley of Hinnom. And this area was associated with human sacrifice in the Old Testament times, and later became associated with the final judgment and the place of torment and punishment for those who were not followers of God. Also, we know that hell is sometimes described as a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth, Matthew 13, verse 42. The torment that probably is being described by the weeping and gnashing of teeth is a torment of one's own decisions. You know how it is when you've made a mistake and you realize that there's nobody else to blame but yourself, and you have to live with those consequences. There's that weeping and gnashing, that sense of just remorse over what happened. It's kind of like when you go to a final and you fail it and you realize, I've got nobody else to blame but myself because I didn't study for it. Or you think about a football player who misses a game-winning catch and pounds on the turf in agony, knowing that he had blown it. That's the kind of torment that's depicted in hell. In addition to that, hell is also referred to as the outer darkness. Matthew 8, verse 12, and being shut out from the presence of the Lord. And so there's a relational separation from God. You know, for some of us, it doesn't seem that bad. How bad would it really be to be separated from God? You know, I mean, in the world that we live in, things are pretty bad. But the fact is, even in this world, we see that there are marks of God. Things like altruism, love. Evil itself is curbed by God himself, we're told, through human institutions like government. We have never experienced a world that has been completely devoid of God. And yet, in hell, people are going to be given over to their own self-centeredness. This is how Tim Keller describes it in his book, Reason for God. He says, the people in hell are miserable. We see raging like unchecked flames their pride, their paranoia, their self-pity, their certainty that everyone else is wrong. All their humanity is gone, and so is their sanity. You know, Keller describes hell, and I think rightly so, as kind of the disintegration of one's being, one's soul. He says they're utterly, finally locked in a prison of their own self-centeredness, and their pride progressively expands into a bigger and bigger mushroom cloud. They continue to go, blaming everyone but themselves. Can you imagine what life would be like where you're confined to a place where you're overstuffed with your ego and you grow progressively more and more self-centered and sick by it? That's what hell's going to be like, according to the Bible. And that's why C.S. Lewis, I think, put it well when he said, there will be two types of people in the end. One who says to God, your will be done, and one to whom God says, your will be done. In other words, it's your choice. Now, we live in a culture today when we talk about things like hell or God's judgment, where it's very controversial. It makes people feel uncomfortable. I have to admit, standing up here talking about this makes me feel uncomfortable as well. What gives me some sense of relief and comfort is the fact that God himself views his own judgment the same way. For example, in Isaiah 28, verse 21, he describes this work of judgment, his strange work, to perform this task, his alien task. God says this is something that he doesn't want to have to do. In addition to that, he says in Ezekiel 18, verse 32, for I take no pleasure in the death of anyone, declares the Lord. Repent and live. God's not happy. He's not sadistic when people are judged or punished. But the reason he needs to do it is because he's just. He's the final arbiter of justice in the universe. And if he simply allowed things to happen, injustice to be unpunished, then it would call into credibility his goodness, his moral perfection. You know, since we're talking about this subject matter, you know, this topic of judgment has been showing up over and over again throughout the book of Revelation. And I think it's worthwhile for us to explore this question that I think people have been asking probably throughout the whole series. How can a loving God send people to hell? You know, I think the first answer that I want to give, which I think, you know, when we investigate this, there are some satisfying answers out there. I remember as a young believer wondering about this very question and an older, more mature Christian showing me some answers, and I just was blown away by how much it made sense, even though it still made me feel uncomfortable. First of all loving persons are sometimes filled with wrath, not in spite of their love, but because of it. I think one of the things that people often wonder is, how can God be loving and be so angry and wrathful? I mean, if you've ever read the Old Testament, and especially the New Testament, a lot of people get this wrong. They think that, oh, Jesus is all about love. He's all about forgiveness and compassion. But then when you look at the God of the Old Testament, I mean, he's angry all the time. This dude needs to chill. But the fact is, when you look at the New Testament, Jesus talks about hell more than any other figure in the New Testament or in the Bible, for that matter. And I think that we all understand that loving, sometimes when we love somebody, loving them actually causes us to be angry. When we see that some sort of wrong is being perpetrated against them, or that they're hurting themselves, it makes us angry. It's the nature of loving people. This is how Becky Peppert puts it. She says, "Think how we feel when we see someone we love ravaged by unwise actions or relationships. Do we respond with benign tolerance as we might towards strangers? Far from it." Yeah, you know, when somebody, a stranger, does something wrong to you, I mean, it kind of makes you angry, but you're sort of like, I don't know that guy. Who cares? But when it's somebody who's close to you, somebody that you love, your spouse, your sibling, you know, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, that makes you angry. It infuriates you. Anger isn't just the opposite of love. Hate is. And in its final form, hate is indifference. God's wrath is not a cranky explosion, but it's his settled opposition to the cancer which is eating out the insides of the human race, which he loves with his whole being. You know, when we think about anger, a lot of times we think of, you know, somebody flying off the handle and just raging on people. That's not the type of wrath that God demonstrates. It's a settled, as Becky Peppert puts it, it's a settled opposition to the wrong in the world and a resolve to do something about it. I like how she puts this. That the opposite of love isn't anger, it's ultimately indifference. The fact that God would actually judge us is an indication of his love. What about this? If God is indifferent to injustice, he would not be worthy of our worship. You know, for us who don't really experience the type of pain and suffering and injustice that you see throughout the world, it's really hard for us to understand this. Here's an excerpt from Miroslav Volf, who actually saw, wars in the Balkans. He's a Croatian theologian. He writes on the subject of God's judgment. He says, "If God were not angry at injustice and deception and did not make a final end to violence, that God would not be worthy of worship. The only means of prohibiting all recourse to violence by ourselves is to insist that it is legitimate only when it comes from God. My thesis that the practice of nonviolence requires a belief in divine vengeance will be unpopular with many in the West, but it takes the quiet of a suburban home for the birth of the thesis that nonviolence comes from belief in God's refusal to judge." In other words, in order for us not to harbor hatred and a desire for vengeance when somebody has killed a family member of ours, or who has perpetrated some sort of unjust act toward our family or our friends, the only thing that can prevent us from taking action ourselves, the only thing that's going to keep us faithful to God's command not to take vengeance, is the fact that we believe that God is the one who ultimately is going to judge that person. Otherwise, we're going to nourish hatred in our hearts that not only is going to tear us apart, but may actually cause us to take matters into our own hands. Also, eliminating hell eliminates human responsibility. John Wenham, in his excellent book called The Goodness of God, says this: "What makes a man human is the fact that he's responsible. Even though his responsibility may be diminished, he knows that he ought to do right and that he deserves punishment if he does not do so. What's most demoralizing, even dehumanizing, is to treat him as wholly non-responsible, simply an innocent victim of heredity and environment. Mental or physical illness may, of course, reduce powers of moral choice to a vanishing point. What is important is that whatever element of moral choice exists should be respected. That is what decisively differentiates man from beasts. If this is not respected, the prisoner or patient is degraded to the status of an animal." And so when we talk about hell, it's a way of God saying, I respect your decision to reject me. God is not going to force himself upon us. Which I think, you know, this leads to the next point, which is that actually God's love demands a hell. It's kind of hard for us, I think, to grasp that idea, but I think it's true. Again, Norm Geisler, another theologian, writes on this. He says, the Bible asserts that God is love, but love cannot act coercively, only persuasively. Forced love is not love, it's rape. A loving being always gives space to others, and he will not force himself upon them against their will. Hence, those who do not choose to love God must be allowed not to love him. Those who do not wish to be with him must be allowed to be separated from him, and hell allows for that separation. I mean, would it really be heaven to somebody who said, I don't believe in Christianity, I don't believe in God, in fact, I don't want to be in God's presence if there is such a thing? Is it right for God to circumvent that person's choice and force them into a situation, into a relationship that they never wanted to have in the first place? The idea of hell creates the opportunity for separation with God. Also, if we're not held responsible for what we do, then who is ultimately held responsible? That's a real big question we need to ask ourselves. If we're not the ones who are personally culpable for the things that we do wrong, then who is? You know, during World War II, the Nazis were almost obsessed with documenting the war and the things that they did. You know, there are many pictures of Nazi soldiers, SS soldiers, herding thousands of Jews to the gas chamber. In this picture, you have a woman running with her child as a Nazi soldier aims to shoot her and her child. Now ask yourself this question. What do you think God's going to say about this? What do you think he's going to say when this SS soldier arrives in heaven, unrepentant for what he's done? Do you think he's going to say, you know what? You grew up in a climate of national socialism. I mean, what other choice did you have? You're a product of your environment. Think he's going to say that? Do you think he's going to say, you know what? You had no choice. I mean, you were just following orders. You had to do it, even though you didn't want to. Do you think he's going to say, you know what? I know what your family life was like. I know that your parents didn't love you and that you grew up with insecurities in your life that drove you to do that. Do you think he's going to say that? I think he's going to say something different. You know what I think he's going to say? I think he's going to say to that person, you are going to pay for this. You think you're going to get away with that? You're going to face my judgment. And I think all of us in our hearts, when we look at something like that, something as heinous as a man shooting down an innocent woman and child, think to ourselves, justice has to be served. This guy isn't going to get away with that. And what if God, like the Hindu God who cannot be differentiated either good or evil, in the end is amoral. Is that God worthy of worship? That calls into question whether or not the God who we know is worthy of being loved, whether he's actually good. And so judgment is a necessity in order to preserve the balance of the universe as well as the justice in the world. Now, I think there are a number of objections to the concept of hell that we should talk about. I think the first is that, you know, some people say, well, the punishment of hell just seems too harsh. I mean, eternal damnation? Well, I'd submit to you that as people who are guilty, whether you want to accept that or not, it's hard for us to suggest what the sentence should be for ourselves. You know, if you went to a prison today and you interviewed people and you'd say, you know, how, do you think that you got a fair sentence? How many people do you think are going to say, you know what, I got exactly what I deserve and I should probably have gotten more? I've been to jail, okay? There ain't that many people like that. Everybody in jail happens to be innocent or unfairly treated. And that's the reason why we don't allow convicted people to determine their own sentence, because they'd be a little bit biased. And so for those of us who are guilty, how can we objectively set a sentence that is fitting for the things that we've done wrong? Human nature dictates that you want to try to minimize or justify the things that you've done wrong, and to take it easy on yourself. You know, this is what Jonathan Edwards says. He says, if we had a true spiritual awareness, we wouldn't be amazed at hell's severity, but we'd be amazed at our own depravity. When we're faced with a perfect moral God, I don't think we're going to be looking at hell and saying, God, that was just too severe. If we make it into heaven, I think what we're going to be saying is, boy, I really don't deserve this. God is so good. Another question that comes up is, why is hell eternal if the sins we commit take place over the course of a few years? In other words, why is there an eternal punishment for a finite amount of sin? But again, I think we need to consider that, you know, in an analogy today, you know, kind of as we think about another scenario, actually kind of makes sense. You know, imagine a guy gets angry and in the heat of the moment pulls out a gun, pulls a trigger and takes somebody's life. That person may spend the rest of their lives in jail, even though it took milliseconds to pull the trigger. And part of the reason why somebody can get judged or punished for that duration of time, even though the act itself was so short, is because of who it is that's being violated. You know, most of us, when we grew up as kids, like to torture things. You know, most of us would go up to an ant when we were little and, you know, rip off its leg and sadistically watch it limp around, crawling in circles. You know, some of us went to extraordinary lengths to torture the bugs. You know, we'd take a magnifying glass and slowly over time heat it up until it was a smoldering piece of collagen or whatever. Now the question is that wrong? Maybe. I mean, felt really good, right? So it's hard to say. Now, think about something else. Think about torturing a dog. I mean, we would look at that differently. In fact, there are people who've gone to jail for torturing animals like that. Well, why do we judge an ant and a dog differently? It's because we view a dog on a higher plane. We see that as a higher being. And of course, as you extrapolate that to human beings, of course, the punishment's going to be even more severe. Because we recognize that human beings are created on a higher order, whether or not we acknowledge that they're even created. Now think about an eternal being like God, who's morally perfect. Don't you think that if you offend or violate an eternal being who's morally perfect, what do you think the sentence should be for that? It seems like the sentence that fits the crime would be eternal death, which is exactly what God says is going to happen. Finally, this is something that's pretty common. I just can't believe in a place like hell. This doesn't seem like it has a lot of substance. You're just like, wait, so you just don't believe? And what, you think it's going to go away? But I do think it has substance. Because I think in our culture today, people are relativistic in their thinking. There's this idea that, you know, whatever's true for you is good for you. Whatever's good for me is good for me. And so believe what you want. So truth is relative. Religious views are relative. It's a matter of personal preference, not objective truth. But the fact is, either a place like hell exists or it doesn't exist. It's a brute fact, one way or the other. And whether we decide to believe in that isn't really going to change that fact. And so the question is Christianity true? That's the question we should be asking ourselves. Now, there is another type of judgment that's described in the Bible. Some of you are like, enough with this judgment stuff, you're killing me. This is a good judgment. In the Bible, there's another type of judgment that's not aimed at people who have died apart from Christ. This is a judgment that's specifically for believers. And sometimes it's referred to, for instance, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, is the Bema Seat of Christ. That is, where God himself will judge believers based on the works that they've done in trying to serve Christ through their lives. This is how Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 13 through 15. At the end, we're told that God will evaluate our work. And Paul says, his work will be shown for what it is. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he'll receive a reward. If it's burned up, he'll suffer loss. Yet he himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. It's clear from this passage that salvation is not even on the table. It's not even what's being discussed. This is talking about whether or not people are going to receive rewards for the faithful life that they've lived for God here on earth. And apparently, God is going to look at our good works and he's going to test it with fire. There are going to be some whose works get burned up. And it's interesting how he describes it, that he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved as yet one escaping through the flames. It's kind of like picturing a person who, you know, wakes up in the middle of the night, they realize that their house is aflame, and they narrowly escape getting out of the flames, having lost everything. On the one hand, they're sad that they lost all of their stuff, but on the other hand, they're happy that they made it, that they're alive. And that's how some believers are going to feel when they experience this judgment. And I don't think it's going to be a sad thing. I think people are going to be overjoyed. I can't believe I made it. So happy that I made it. But there are going to be those who receive a reward. Those who have lived faithfully for Christ in this life. And this is a really cool thing that the Bible talks about. That in addition to God purchasing our salvation, he actually gives us an opportunity to serve him and then rewards us as his co-laborer. Some of the things that he's going to reward us for or reward us with will be hearing him say to us, "Well done, good and faithful servant." In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus tells this parable of the talents, and he gives a sum of money to three of these servants. And when he returns, the landowner takes an account, and two of the guys who show back up doubled the money that the landowner had given. And the landowner says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into your master's joy." The landowner, who represents God, is pleased that those servants have actually served him and have done something with what he's given them. And so likewise, God is going to take an account of the things that he's given to us, namely our intelligence, namely our drive, namely our talents, our gifts, and he's going to say, "What did you do with this? What did you do with all the resources that I gave to you?" And if we can come to him and say, "I tried my best to serve you with my life," he's going to say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." So many of us long for admiration. So many of us long for people telling us, "You did a good job." For some of us, it's what drives us. It's what drives us to succeed. It's what drives us to have a lot of money so that people can acknowledge us. But have you ever noticed that even when you attain that acknowledgement, it still feels a little empty, a little hollow? The reason it feels that way is because we were meant to be praised by God himself. And it's going to be amazing. I remember when I first started teaching on this level, my mentor would sit in the room. I'd be sitting in a room with 400 people in it, and I'll tell you what, it was almost like everybody in the room vanished, and the only thing that I cared about was what he thought about it, because I respected him so much. And imagine that, God the Father, the creator of the universe, saying to you, you did a good job. It's going to be amazing. This is how C.S. Lewis puts it. He says, nothing is so obvious in a child as the great and undistinguished pleasure in being praised by his parents or a teacher, to have the satisfaction of having pleased those whom he has rightly loved and respected. And that is enough to raise our thoughts to what may happen when beyond all hope and nearly beyond all belief at last learn that we have pleased him whom we are created to please. We will be free from the miserable illusion that it was our doing. With no taint of prideful self-approval, we will most innocently rejoice in the thing that God has made us to be. You get to rejoice in the praise that you get, but it's not going to be self-centered. It's not going to be tainted by pride. It's going to be exactly what God intended. In addition to that, we get to see people who we played a role in leading to Christ. Some of those people we're not even going to know. We're going to meet for the very first time. And it's going to be amazing. Imagine showing up into heaven, meeting the God of the universe, and then afterward, people coming around you and saying, thank you so much for sharing the love of Jesus Christ with me. If you didn't have the courage to step out in faith and do that, I wouldn't be here. People coming up to you you've never met before and saying, if you had not contributed financially to that one worker who decided to move to the other part of the world to share the good news with me, I wouldn't be here right now. If you didn't invest in that one person and show them what the Bible had to say and arm them with these different answers to difficult questions, I would have never gotten my questions answered. And I probably wouldn't even be a believer. It's going to be amazing. We're going to have that. This is what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 19 and 20. He says, for what is our hope, our joy, or our crown in which we will glory in the presence of our Lord Jesus when he comes? Is it not you? Indeed, you are our glory and our joy. It's going to be the people. It's not going to be the things around us that are going to make us happy. Those aren't going to be the rewards. It's going to be the people. I got my first taste of this as a very young Christian. I remember I was maybe walking with God for a couple years, and I had the privilege of going to Cambodia for the first time, 2001. And we stopped over, we had a layover in New Jersey for the night. And so I went to the bar to hang out with a few people. And we had a few drinks, and one of the guys who was with me, we were sitting at the bar messing around, and I said, hey, Chris, you ever had a redheaded slut before? And he kind of looked at me confused. I said, no, dude, you have to understand, it's a drink. And I said, I'd order you one, but they don't have Jägermeister, which is an ingredient. And I see out of my peripheral view this hand point to a bottle up on the shelf. And I turn over, and it's this 40-year-old guy. He says, well, there's a bottle right there. And so I start talking to him, and it turns out he's a policeman at the airport. And he left his accounting job, and he started using terms like, I feel called to this profession and all this other stuff. And in the course of the conversation, it came out that, he had a background in church, but it was clear that he had never had a personal relationship with God. He didn't understand God's forgiveness or why Jesus even came. And so as we're sitting there talking, having a drink, I started sharing with him the love of God. Started sharing with him that Jesus died to forgive us for all the things that we've ever done wrong. And he was blown away. He's like, after 25 years of going to church, I've never heard that before. And he was just completely blown away. I said, well, have you ever turned to Christ and ever asked him for forgiveness for the things that you've done wrong? He said, I don't think so. And so in that moment, I started to feel kind of a agitation. I sensed that it was the Spirit probably prompting me, just go for it. You're never going to see this guy again. Be bold. And so I said, well, why don't we pray right now? And he looked at me, he's like, right now? I said, yeah, why not? And he was a little bit reluctant, and so we talked a little bit more, but finally he came to the place, he's like, I think I'm ready. And so right there at the bar, you know, with drinks in our hands, we sat there and we bowed our head and started praying. And he just started repeating the words after me. Enthusiastically at the end, we both said, amen. And, you know, the bartender's standing there cleaning out a glass like, what is wrong with these dudes? These guys are drunk. And so we kind of sat there. It was a little bit awkward. And I said, how do you feel? And he's like, I feel great, man. He's like, I feel like that was real. And so I didn't know how to end the conversation. So I was like, oh, okay, it looks like it's about time for me to go to bed now. I've got to get up early. And so I stood up, and right before I left, I said, you know what, I realized I never asked you for your name. He kind of looked at me, he smiled. He's like, my name's Bill. I said, well, Bill, I guess I'll see you around. And I kind of paused because I'm like, when am I ever going to see you again? And I said, well, maybe in the next life we'll see each other. And he looked at me and smiled. I believe that one day when I arrive in heaven, I'm going to see Bill. And hopefully countless others who are going to be there. It's going to be an amazing thing. Well, let's move on to Revelation 21. Starting in verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And so remember, earth and heaven ran away from God when he came in its presence. And now we see that the new heaven and new earth come in, for the first earth and the first heaven has passed away. This part about there being no longer any sea is troubling to some. They're just like, you know, what? I mean, no Holden Beach, no yellowfin tuna. Like, I mean, dude, what the hell? If you know the context of Revelation, the sea refers to, it's symbolic of humanity that's in rebellion against God. And so what this is describing is a new heavens and new earth without anybody rebelling against God. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. We saw this imagery last time of how often the church is described as the bride. But in this case, it's apparently the holy city descending, the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, merging with earth itself. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. This term here, the dwelling of God is with men, that term is very interesting. It's the word skene in Greek, which means to dwell or dwelling place. It's often used throughout the Old Testament. In fact, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, this same word is used of the tabernacle in the Old Testament, in Exodus. When the Jews escaped from Egypt, God said, I want you to build this tabernacle, which was kind of like a mobile worship tent. And whenever they would wander somewhere and settle, they would set up this tabernacle and God's presence would fill the tabernacle. It indicated his dwelling place on earth. Then we're told that when Israel finally got into the promised land in Jerusalem, that when the temple was actually built, that his dwelling place became the temple of God, the temple that was set up in Jerusalem. And then it had its next incarnation in Jesus, who we're told in John 1:14 became the dwelling of God on earth. And finally, we're told that in its ultimate fulfillment, when God sets up the new heavens and new earth, his final kingdom, that he will finally make his dwelling on earth with man. And we're told that we will be his people, and God himself will be them and be their God. This is again a reference to the Old Testament, where God promises over and over again, first to Abraham, and then reiterated to Moses, and finally to the church, that I will be your God and you will be my people. And so we see that this scene right here is the fulfillment of all the prophecy that is ever talked about in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, and finds its final consummation in this moment. And we're told in verse 4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the older order of things has passed away. The reason why every tear will be dried and why there will be no more mourning is because we're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 56, that the final enemy, death itself, will be swallowed up by victory. That God himself at this moment will abolish death that affects all of us. You know, when I picture heaven, a lot of times I think to myself, I think I had it better off on earth because at least I get more access to him now than I do in heaven. You know, you imagine going to see Jesus and it's going to be like a 20-mile long line. But we're told that we actually get more access, that he himself will actually comfort us. Using maybe the most tender imagery that you can think of a father wiping away the tear of his children. No more death. No more people dying early before their time. I mean, I experienced this while I was living even in a ministry house. This guy who was living with us, walking believer, he showed up with cancer again, leukemia. He's 23 years old, took his life. I had to bury him myself. Did his eulogy. And I just thought to myself, how can life be cut short like this? There's so much mourning. You know, just a couple weeks ago, my brother-in-law, who's not a believer in Christ and is actually pretty hesitant to talk about spiritual things, said to me, he said, you know, my five-year-old keeps asking me, what is death? And he said, it just happens to everyone. And after he left, I thought to myself, that's not an explanation, that's an observation. We have an explanation. We're not like those who die without hope. I like the way that Randy Alcorn depicts this in a story that he tells in his book, Heaven. He says, when 5-year-old Emily Kimball was hospitalized and heard that she was going to die, she started to cry. Even though she loved Jesus and wanted to be with him, she didn't want to leave her family behind. Then her mother had an inspired idea. She asked Emily to step through a doorway into another room. Then she closed the door behind her. One at a time, the entire family started coming through the door to join her. Her mother explained this is how it would be. Emily would go ahead to heaven and the rest of the family would follow. Emily understood. She would be the first to go through death's door. Eventually, the rest of the family would follow, probably one by one, joining her on the other side. We have hope. And the hope is that our name is written in the book of life. God himself has conquered death through the cross so that we don't have to experience the second death and that we can live with him eternally, never having to experience death again, never having to see death again. God himself comforting us. No more sickness, no more people dying prematurely, but us living with God eternally. Verse 5, he who is seated on the throne said, I'm making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. Then he said to me, it's done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. Again, this phrase, the Alpha and the Omega, is used in Revelation 1:8, but again is emphasized here in Revelation 21, verse 6, to describe God's eternality, that he has no beginning and no end, that he's all-powerful. And in addition to that, he's told that all those who are occupying the new heavens and new earth will be able to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. Without cost. He says that people will be able to freely drink and experience eternal life because of what Christ has done. Finally, verse 7, he who overcomes will inherit all of this, and I will be his God, and you will be his son. Okay, let's draw some conclusions. I think the first thing, and maybe the most obvious from this, is that Christianity has satisfying answers to difficult questions. There are real answers out there. Some of you came as skeptics. Some of you thought to yourself, you know, there's no way that I'm going to get any sort of resolution on the questions that I have. This is just really, I think, kind of a summary view of this. There's a lot out there. So I'd encourage you, if you have questions, to explore, to get those questions answered. They're satisfying intellectual answers, even though sometimes emotionally it's hard for us to take. Secondly, we will all stand guilty before God. One day we will be resurrected and we will have to either find our names written in the book of life, or we'll have to look at the book of works. The Bible says that everything that we've ever done, not just the things that we've done wrong, but also the things that we have failed to do, like love and acknowledge God and serve people and opportunities that we should have, that we're going to have to stand before God because of those things. But God says that the only way to escape his judgment is making sure that your name is written in the book of life. And the only way that your name gets put in there is through what Jesus has done. The only way. I skipped this verse, but in Revelation 20, verse 15, it says, all whose names were written in the book of life did not experience the second death. If you're here tonight and you don't know God in a personal way, God is inviting you to have your name put in the book of life, to experience everlasting joy and comfort that he wants to offer you in the next life. All right, next week, heaven. And in heaven, I won't go over an hour when I'm teaching. I don't know if there are, if you're a first-time guest, you can get a book, Discovering God, which outlines some difficult questions that people pose about Christianity in the Bible. It's free if you're a first-timer here. I don't know if there are any questions or comments or thoughts.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.